Okay, so we left off last 2 weeks ago. We left off towards the end of chapter 8. We finished the story of the AI, and we analyzed that whole story with Jericho, the AI, and all of that. And now we're starting a brand new topic in verse 30. So chapter 8, verse 30. Then Joshua built an altar to the Lord God of Israel on Mount Ebal. Okay. And we continue in verse 31, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the Torah of Moses, an altar of whole stones, which have not been cut by metal. And he sacrificed upon it whole burnt offerings to the Lord. And they sacrificed shlamim, peace offerings. Okay, so we have here the erection of a altar on Mount Ebal, and this is something that had been commanded by Moses previously. And we're going to go check out exactly what was commanded. And then we learn that he wrote there on these stones, Mishnah Torah Moshe. The Mishnah Torah is literally means the repetition or the doubling of the Torah, of the instruction of Moses. Now, I will point out to you that the book of Deuteronomy, the word itself means second, it's second or double Torah, double teaching, Deuteronomy, that's what it means. And it is the Latin of a Hebrew word, Mishnah Torah, which is exactly the same word that's used here. And so it is commonly believed that what was actually written here was the book of Deuteronomy. And the reason the book of Deuteronomy is called the double or second Torah is because so much of Deuteronomy is a repetition or a summary of what went before. It is, of course, Moses' speeches to the nation, and he is summarizing. He is summarizing some of the commandments. He is summarizing a lot of the history and the events that took place, and that is why it is referred to that. So that is probably what was written here, which was written before the children of Israel. Okay, so we have two things going on. First of all, there's an altar. Second of all, there's a writing of scripture itself on these massive stones. Okay, and we learn here in verse 33, and all of Israel, the elders and the officials and the judges, stood from here and from there on either side of the ark, opposite the priests and the Levites who were carrying the ark of the covenant of the Lord. The stranger, the citizen, half opposite Mount Gerizim, half opposite Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded to bless the nation of Israel from the beginning. Afterwards, they called all the words of the Torah. They announced or recited these words of the Torah, the blessing and the curse, as is written in the book of the Torah. There was nothing that Moses had commanded that Joshua did not recite here opposite the entire congregation of Israel, the women and the children and the stranger who walked amongst them. Okay, so this is a story that takes place on Mount Ebal initially, and then we learn that the nation is split up and standing half opposite or along the slopes of Mount Gerizim, half along the slopes of Mount Ebal. And to exactly understand what happened here, I want to first go back to the very place where Moses was actually commanding the nation of what to do. And this story begins in Deuteronomy 11. Now, I will warn you, some of you have been with me at the Three Seas Outlook, where we're standing and actually viewing these mountains, Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, and we also see the Oak of Moreh at the same place. And I've some of this teaching I have given there. So you may have heard this from me. Some of you may have heard this from me several times. Well, you could sign out now if you've had enough, that's okay. But now we're going to be learning it from the perspective of Joshua 8, okay? So the story begins actually in Deuteronomy 11, verse 26, where God says, or actually Moses says, "Behold, I place before you today a blessing and a curse. a blessing if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command to you today, and a curse if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, and you stray from the path which I command to you today, to follow strange gods which you have not known. So we have here an introduction. Something is going to happen, having to do with blessings and a curse, and the blessings and the curses are defined. The blessings are the rewards if they follow God's commandments, and the curses are the punishments if they do not follow God's commandments. And then we learn of a very specific ceremony that Moses here is going to command them to do, and it is this commandment that Joshua 8 is referring to. And it will come to pass when the Lord your God will bring you to the land that you are going there to inherit. You shall place the blessing on Mount Gerizim and the curse on Mount Ebal. And then scripture tells us where those two mountains are located. In verse 30, they are on the other side of the Jordan. This is being commanded to them while they're east of the Jordan River. So this is west of the Jordan River. They're on the other side of the Jordan in the direction of the setting sun, in the land of the Canaanite who dwells in the Arava, opposite the Gilgal, near the Oaks of Moreh. Now, the Oaks of Moreh, of course, is a place we have met before. We've met this place in Genesis 12 because it is Abraham's first stop in the land of Israel. And it's when he gets to the land of Israel, his first stop at the Oak of Moreh, it is there that God promises to Abraham for the first time, I will give this land to your children. And there are only two times in the Bible that this place, the Oak of Moreh, is mentioned, here and in Genesis 12. So basically what's happening here is that Moses is commanding the children of Israel to come into the land of Israel to carry out some kind of ceremony of blessings and curses at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, which are right next to the Oak of Moreh, where God's first promise to Abraham regarding the land and the children of Israel is recited. Liz, you had a question?
Yes, please. What was the Deuteronomy reference? What was the Deuteronomy reference?
Deuteronomy 11, verses 26 through 30.
Thank you.
Okay. All right. So this is where the actual command is set forth. Now, let me just clarify. What are blessings and curses? We talked about rewards and punishments, but it's all part of a system that is actually a covenant system. Okay. And the actual text of the covenant, we meet later on in Deuteronomy 27 and 28. But just to give you an understanding what a covenant means, a covenant is essentially a contract. There are two sides to the contract. In this case, the two sides are the God of Israel and the nation of Israel. And God has put forth commandments. And he has said to the nation of Israel, we're making a contract, okay? If you, nation of Israel, obey these commandments, in other words, if you fulfill your obligations under the contract, then you will be rewarded. You will receive blessings. However, if you breach the contract, if you fail to live up to your part of the contract, then God says there will be damages. Okay, that's the punishment. There will be damages. There will be punishment. There will be a price to pay. The nation of Israel will have a price to pay. Now, the actual text of this covenant, as I said, in Deuteronomy 27 and 28. So we have a few additional details going on here. First of all, we have Deuteronomy 27. Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the nation, saying, obey all of this commandment which I command to you today. And it will come to pass on the day that you cross the Jordan to the land that the Lord your God will give you, you shall erect huge stones, and you shall cover them with limestone, and you shall write upon them the words of this Torah, okay, as you pass, in order that when you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as God spoke to the gods of your fathers. And when you pass the Jordan, you will erect these stones, as I command you today, on Mount Ebal, and you will cover them with limestone. And you will build there an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones upon which no that have not been hewn by metal, by iron, okay? Whole stones, from whole stones, you will build this altar to the Lord your God, and you will raise up there burnt offerings, and you will also sacrifice peace offerings, and you'll eat it there, and you will take pleasure in the Lord your God, and you will write on these stones all of the words of the Torah, of this Torah. So here, of course, we see in Deuteronomy 27, the command having to do with both the altar on Mount Ebal and the setting up of the stones. Now, we saw that already in Joshua 8. The first step of this whole thing was to build this altar out of these unhewn stones and to write out the words of the Torah. And in this case, we talked about the words of Deuteronomy on these huge stones. So, and it's, of course, in Joshua 8, we read about how this is something that Moses was commanded, and they did exactly as Moses commanded. And we see here, with regard to the altar and the stones, this is the source of it in Deuteronomy 27. Okay, and then we continue in verses 9 and 10. Moses and the priests and the Levites said to all of Israel, "Listen, Israel, on this day you have become a nation to the Lord your God." And you have a sense here that whatever ceremony is going to take place in Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, the purpose of it is to fulfill this declaration. Today, you will become a people of the Lord your God. And I think this reinforces the idea that we're having a covenant ceremony. It is the relationship that is expressed by covenant, the relationship between God and the nation of Israel, this formal relationship that will take place for the first time in the land of Israel. We have covenant before. There's a covenant at Sinai. Well, first of all, we have covenants with the fathers, you know, with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's a different nature of covenant. Those covenants are more like promises, less like two-way contracts, but it's also with the forefathers. We have a covenant for the first time between God and the nation of Israel at Sinai, okay? I believe it's chapter 24 in Exodus. We have an additional covenant here, okay, here in Deuteronomy. But here, it's a covenant that I call split covenant. The commandment is given in the plains of Moab here on the eastern side of the Jordan. But Moses makes it very clear that what is actually going to take place, the ceremony itself, or the real ceremony, shall we say, is taking place at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal after they enter the land. But what we will see here is in Deuteronomy 27 and 28, we have the full text of the covenant. Now, you can read this covenant if you like. It's very depressing because there's far more verses dealing with curses and punishment than there are with the rewards and blessings. So if you want to just read the rewards and blessings, you'll feel good. But then if you want to find out what happens when Israel breaches the contract, then you have to read all this stuff, and it's extremely depressing. In fact, when it is the Torah portion, Ki Tavoh, this is in the Torah portion of Ki Tavoh, and it is always read in the end of the summer, very close to Rosh Hashanah, okay? And it this section of the curses is always read much softer, okay? Usually you have the person who's in the middle of the synagogue at the Bima, and he's reading the Torah very loudly for everyone to hear. When they get to the part of the curses, he lowers his voice. And nobody objects, because nobody really wants to hear all of this, okay? We have to hear it, right? And actually, the fact that it comes out close to Rosh Hashanah, is very often seen as significant because, you know, as we, Rosh Hashanah is a day of judgment, is a day we come before our Maker and we confess our sins and we pray for a better chance, another chance, a new year. So it's kind of like that warning that comes right before that says, okay, remember all the things that you did wrong and remember the punishments you should get so that you are then going to pray that God should, you know, forgive you as opposed to, and instead of bringing you the punishment. But anyway, that's what we have here in Deuteronomy 27, 28. Now, the very, very end verse of 28 is what creates a bit of confusion. It says, these are the words of the covenant which God commanded Moses to enter into with the children of Israel in the land of Moab, in addition to the covenant which he entered into with them in Chorev. So the question is, does this verse mean that the covenant itself is entered into with the nation in Moab, or does it just mean that Moses commanded God commanded Moses in the land of Moab? And what exactly happened here? Now, we do know that there was the actual covenant in Mount Gerizim. So it's possible that the text of this was read out to the nation without the exact execution of the contract, because the execution of that covenant really happens when we in our chapter in Joshua 8. Anyway, so that's the background that we need to have for all of this. Okay, so let's go back to Joshua 8, because there's actually two things going on here. And I would say until recent years, we would read these verses in chapter 8 just as a continuous thing, that there was an altar on Mount Ebal, and while they were standing at the altar, watching, you know, this altar on Mount Ebal, at some point the nation divides to half on Mount Gerizim, half on Mount Ebal, but it's like the altar on Mount Ebal is all part of the same ceremony of the covenant that's taking place when the nation is split between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. But then there was a man named Adam Zartel, who was an archaeologist, and he discovered the actual altar of Joshua. Now, can you see this picture? Okay, I'm showing you a photograph. Just nod if you can see it. Okay, good. Now, that's me over here. Raising my hand because I'm giving part of this talk over there. This is photographed at the Three Seas Outlook. But what I want to show you is the three mountains that are behind me. You see my arrow pointing. This mountain over here, it's actually it's going from south to north. Okay, that's the direction. And here we're standing to the east of these mountains. This mountain over here is Mount Gerizim. Just to the north of that is Mount Ebal. You can see that these mountains are you know connected by a narrow valley. What's actually in this valley today is the city of Shechem. We know that in biblical times, the city of Shechem at the very least was here at the eastern edge of those mountains. Probably also went a bit into between those mountains. Okay, we don't know how much at the other end it went at that time, but certainly at this eastern edge. Then we also had biblical Shechem. So if Mount Gerizim, Mount Ebal, and then we have over here another mountain, okay? That mountain is the Oak of Moreh. So if you remember when the Bible tells us Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal are right next to the Oak of Moreh, it is, it's right next to it, okay? Now, because of the way we would normally read Joshua 8, we would assume that if the half of the nation is up Mount Gerizim and half of the nation is up Mount Ebal, then we would assume that the altar that was built on Mount Ebal would be in this direction somewhere. Somewhere over here on the southern edge of the southern slope of Mount Ebal, so that everyone standing here on these two slopes would be able to see the altar. And for many years, there were many archaeologists who were searching all over this side of Mount Ebal for some kind of remains of an altar, and they never found anything. Adam Zartel, who was a biblical archaeologist from the University of Haifa, he was responsible immediately after the Six-Day War for what they call an archaeological survey of Samaria. An archaeological survey means that you don't do go in a place and do a dig, but you kind of canvass broad areas to see where are there, archaeological remains, what they may be, and you kind of note them so that later on someone can go back and do a more in-depth archaeological dig at that place. And as part of that, he noticed over here on this side, on the northern edge of Mount Ebal, he noticed what looked like an altar or some kind of ceremonial site. He later went back and dug in earnest and uncovered what he believed to be the actual altar of Joshua. Now, that altar, there are many reasons to assume and what he used as his basis. First of all, we read here both in Deuteronomy and in Joshua, the two kinds of sacrifices, okay, the burnt offerings and the peace offerings. If you go back to Leviticus, it's also very specific what kind of animals are used in those two different kinds of offerings, okay? What he found there were animals that fit 100% the profile of those animals, but not just the fact that it was the type of animal, but the age of the animal. You know, we have one-year-old animals, we have three-year-old animals, and it was exactly those animals. Also, unlike altars in different parts of the land of Israel that are clearly Canaanite altars, where you find the remains of what were considered impure animals under the Bible, you don't see any impure animals here in this altar on Mount Ebal. Also, as he uncovered it more, he saw the way it was built, the dimensions of it, the fact that there was a ramp going up to it, all of which comport 100% with the description of the altar for the tabernacle that we learned in the book of Exodus. Also, it comports with the dimensions and the description of the altar that is mentioned in the Mishnah. The Mishnah is a series of books that are from during and after the Second Temple period, where they discuss the, you know, things that they know firsthand. What were the dimensions of the altar in the Second Temple? And this very much dimensions and the way it looked, etc., very much comports to what they found there in Mount Ebal. Okay, so from all these indications and others, carbon dating and all kinds of other things, it has become clear that this is indeed the altar of Joshua. So then the question became, what do we do with an altar on this side of Mount Ebal if indeed we learn that the ceremony is taking place here between the slopes of Mount Gerizim and the slopes of Mount Ebal? The understanding is that it is the priests that are standing in the middle and reciting the blessings and the curses to the people standing on each side of the mountain, and then they say amen. Now, remember in Deuteronomy 11, we learned that they will place the blessings on Mount Gerizim, which is here, and the curses on Mount Ebal. What that means is that when they recite the blessings, they look towards Mount Gerizim. When we recite the curses, they look towards Mount Ebal, okay? So all this makes a lot of sense, except what do we do with the fact that the altar's on the other side? Now, Adam Zartel himself came up with a theory I don't like. But I'll tell you his theory. His theory is, this is not Mount Gerizim. Now, I need you to know, why do we think it's Mount Gerizim? First of all, the Samaritans. The Samaritans consider Mount Gerizim their holy mountain. And going back to Second Temple times, they have been there on Mount Gerizim. In fact, there is evidence of a huge temple on Mount Gerizim, and that is supported by historical evidence. The Samaritans were rivals to the Jews. The Samaritans were probably included remnants from the northern kingdom, but were for the most part people who had come from the east when the Assyrians mixed up the populations. This is told to us in 2 Kings chapter 17. When the northern kingdom is exiled and taken further to the east and to the north, the Assyrians bring at the same time other peoples from Moab and from those areas to the east and bring them into Samaria. And they develop, they actually adopt parts of the Torah, parts of the Jewish faith, but they develop it in their own way. And these are the people that become the Samaritans that we meet again later on under with Ezra and Nehemiah. They become people who are trying to prevent the Jews from building the temple in Jerusalem. And they also show up in the New Testament as people that are near Shechem, okay? So Shechem is here. That's a fact, okay? This mountain, the Samaritans call Mount Gerizim. Now, the Samaritans call Mount Gerizim now for 2,000 years. It's not from yesterday. So that's a very, very old tradition that, in fact, this is Mount Gerizim. Now, it's possible that sometime between the time of Joshua and the time of the Samaritans, the name of Mount Gerizim shifted. It's possible, but it's unlikely, okay? But that is what Adam Zartel is saying. He's saying this is not Mount Gerizim. He's saying that the Oak of Moreh over here is not the Oak of Moreh, but it is Mount Gerizim. And he contends that the nation gathers in between these two mountains. And in fact, he finds this huge plain. You don't really see it from here. It's on the other side of Mount Ebal, but very close to where the altar was. There's a huge plain there. And so he contends that that is where they are. You can agree with that. And you can disagree with it. I disagree with it. I like the fact that I think looking at these mountains, I'll tell you something else. The word Shechem itself, Shechem in Hebrew, means shoulder. And if you look at the way these mountains are built with Shechem in between, this looks like shoulder blades, okay? And the Shechem is in between the shoulder blades. So also the name of the town, it just all fits together to see that Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal is over here. So then what do you do with the fact that the altar is over here? So for this, we will go back. We will go back to Joshua 8. First of all, if we go to initially to Deuteronomy 27, we will see that there is a separation. Okay. Verses 1 through 8 tell us about what's going on Mount Ebal, the altar and the big stones. Okay. Then we have verses 9 and 10. They talk about them becoming a nation. And beginning in verse 11, we have, and these will stand on Mount Gerizim, and these will stand on Mount Ebal. Okay? From these verses, you can well understand that this is actually two completely different ceremonies. There will be an altar on Mount Ebal, and there will be the stones with the scripture written there. And then there will be this massive ceremony with all the tribes laid out between Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And in fact, if you look in chapter 27, the people that are together with Moses at that point are the elders, okay? Now, let's go back to Joshua 8. In Joshua 8, it says that at that time, Joshua built this altar on Mount Ebal, and he did all this stuff with the stones, okay? And and look at verse 33. And all of Israel and the elders and the officials and the priests were standing on each side of the ark with the priests and the Levites carrying the Ark of the Covenant. Okay? If you pause, okay, at the stranger and the citizen, okay, and you pause there. Okay, what you can see is that there was this initial occurrence at Mount Ebal on the other side of Mount Ebal, and it was not in the presence of all of the nations. It was in presence of the elders and the officials, okay? That's up until verse 33, but through verse 32, okay? And then beginning in verse 33, we suddenly get everybody. All of Israel, the elders, the officials, etc. And then we have half on Mount Gerizim and half on Mount Ebal, okay? And then we have the blessings and the curse read out as is described in verse 34. There's a rabbi by the name of Yoel Ben Nun that very much agreed with Adam Zartel that he had discovered the altar of Joshua, but did not agree with Adam Zartel that suddenly what we thought is the Old Gemara becomes Mount Gerizim. And what he says, if you look both in Deuteronomy 27 and here at these verses, we're talking about two totally separate ceremonies. The altar at Mount Ebal is done in the presence of the elders alone. Then they move to the other side of Mount Ebal, where half of the nation is up on Mount Gerizim, half of the nation is on Mount Ebal, waiting for them to come. And when they come, they bless the nation, they bring the ark with them, they bless the nation, and we have the ceremony of the blessings and the curse. I'll just move that picture for now. Okay, I just want to conclude with one more thing about all of this, okay? This covenant ceremony is significant. It is the first time a covenant is entered into between God of Israel and the people of Israel in the land of Israel. And if we go back to Deuteronomy, we will find in chapter 30, what I would like to call an addendum to this covenant, because the end of the covenant at the end of 28, it ends really bad. All the curses and the ultimate curse is exile from the land. And if you stop there, you might think that if they sin, they will be thrown out of the land. End of story. But remember, and I think here it's very significant, this whole ceremony is taking place right next to the Oak of Moreh, where God first promised the land to Abraham. And God makes it very clear to Abraham, this will be an everlasting possession. So how do you reconcile that if they break the covenant, they're exiled, and end of story, and yet we would have this everlasting possession promised? Well, the answer to that is in Deuteronomy 30, which is kind of like an addendum. And it will come to pass when all these things, the blessing and the curse, which I've placed before you, have come to be. And the Lord will restore you from all the nations where the Lord has dispersed you, and you will return to the Lord your God. And let's go further to verse 3. The Lord your God will restore you. He will take mercy upon you. He will return and gather you from all the nations to which the Lord your God has spread you. If you will be dispersed to the ends of the earth, from there the Lord your God will gather you, and from there he will take you. And the Lord your God will bring you to the land that your fathers have inherited, and you will inherit it, and you will prosper and multiply more than your fathers. This then is the end of the story. As they're standing there at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, and they're listening to the blessings and the curses, and they know that if they disobey God, it will end badly for them. They will be exiled. At the same time, they are recited Deuteronomy 30. At the same time, they are told, but God will bring you back. It will not be the end of the story. And I believe this promise of Deuteronomy 30 seared into the hearts and souls of the people standing there at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal is what keeps our nation alive. Because we always know, and especially as those people there are looking across at the Oak of Moreh and remembering how the story began, how God made a promise to Abraham, and it took 400 years, but that promise was fulfilled. As they're standing there at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, they know they can rely on the promise of Deuteronomy 30, that even if they will sin and they will suffer and they will be exiled, they will one day return to the land. And of course, what we are witnessing today is that return to the land of Israel, that return to Samaria, that return to Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. And if anybody tells you that the Jews can stay in Tel Aviv, but they have no place in Samaria, you just teach them this. You know, this is where it began. This is where the covenant was entered into. We are centered and focused in Samaria, and that is where we will remain. Please, God. That's it for today. Any questions or comments?
Amazing. Beautiful. Very nice and beautiful. And thank you very much. And can I say something that does not belong to this subject? I'm happy to see among your people this Maria from Guatemala. I'm very happy to see her. I don't know if you know about it. I'm giving a lecture about King David, and when Jerusalem became the capital, you would not believe, Guatemala have 27 seized cities in the country that have a street with written in Hebrew, Rehov Yerushalayim Birat Israel. And I want you to see it here.
Wow. That means Jerusalem Street, the capital of Israel. Wow. Yes. That's in Guatemala.
That's in Guatemala. And when I saw this woman, I said, and I'm giving a lecture about King David in 2 weeks. And I'm showing him this. And then I see a person from Guatemala. So I just had to say it. I'm sorry.
That's wonderful.
Sandra, thank you so much. And greetings from the start of week, Sandra. And Happy New Year to the 28 participants. I have one question for you, Sandra.
Sure,
I am very concerned what's going on now in Samaria. They're attacking, they're killing Jewish people in Samaria. I want your opinion, what the Israeli government should be doing to protect the people of Samaria. I'd like to hear what you think.
Okay, well, first of all, you know, the IDF is in Samaria, And they are doing a great deal to protect. For every terrorist attack we hear about, what we don't hear about is the many terrorist attacks that they have prevented. They don't always have all the equipment and all the know-how they should. And one of the things that we are very involved with at CFOIC is providing security equipment to beef up what the IDF can do. Providing security cameras is a huge issue because we've been able to prevent many security, many terrorist attacks and infiltrations into communities where we have succeeded in putting up surveillance cameras and getting the IDF there in advance of the attack to prevent it as opposed to after the fact. So that's something that we are very involved with. Now, what's going on now, unfortunately, there's also some politics involved. I was very distressed to read after this young boy, Yehuda Dimantman, a young man, was murdered just over a week ago. He was near a place called Chomesh. It's one of the communities that was destroyed in the disengagement, which, of course, was a terrible thing. But there has been no Jewish official settlement there, although over the years, there are groups of people who go up there and then they're removed and they go up there and they're removed. And it's a very controversial subject in a very controversial area. And whether you think it's a wise idea to establish Chomesh right now or not, unfortunately, what has happened is right after he was murdered, they created a groundswell of support for the yeshiva, for the people who are sitting there and learn and studying Bible there. To protect them and to give them better accommodations. And rather than open discussions with the government to try to see how to improve the conditions of the people living there, instead the IDF came and destroyed some more of the buildings there. And, you know, whether or not within Israeli policy it's a wise thing to have Chomesh or not, that's not the point. Because this was interpreted, I'm sure, by the Palestinians as a reward for their terrorist attack. And so that for us is extremely, extremely disturbing. Our government is a weird, motley government. I am sure that Naftali Bennett is in favor of expanding settlements in Judea and Samaria, but unfortunately he has some very problematic bedfellows in his government. And I do believe that this was a huge mistake. On the other hand, I believe that as the leadership in Judea and Samaria, what we need to be focusing on is not Chomesh, which in and itself has so much controversy surrounding it, also problematic security issues. But for example, the government promised some months ago to legalize Eviatar. We have a whole list of young pioneering communities all over Judea and Samaria that have been around for a long time. Families are living and they need to be legalized. If I were the leadership of Judea and Samaria, I would be focusing on that because these are the far more immediate issues with far less controversy. And I think would be more significant because it would spread us out in many more places where we would have a foothold in areas where the Palestinians are just dying to get rid of us, as opposed to Chomesh, which is in this very remote area. But anyway, that's just my opinion.
Thank you very much. This past 2 weeks Torah portion clearly depicted that Judea and Samaria belongs to Israel. I believe that, you believe that, and that's the way it's got to be.
100%. 100%. Yes. Carolyn, did you have something to say? Okay. Anyone else have something
to say?
Pauline.
I just wondered about, we hear of the Palestinians taking over vast swathes of Area C. How is that not stopped by the government or something? Because, I mean, that's legally... It's clearly set out what is legally Palestinian, what is legally, and C is Israeli.
100%.
And nothing seems to be done. And the EU and the Palestinians, they just...
Certainly not enough is being done. And it's one of the greatest puzzlements for me. And I am very annoyed with it. The only thing I can say is I find it, you know, I get very annoyed with politicians, as we all do, okay? Because this is an issue that's been going on for a number of years. Netanyahu was the prime minister when this began, and he did absolutely nothing to stop it, especially when it was in its infancy and much more easily stopped. Today, all of a sudden that he's in the opposition, he's accusing the current government of not doing anything. You know, but it's like, you know, people who live in glass houses don't throw stones. You know, he is where the problem began. So I look at all of these politicians and I say, a plague on all your houses. Okay, because this is a huge issue. And you know what? It's not just in Judea and Samaria. In the Negev, for example. Now, there's absolutely no controversy as to whether the Negev belongs to Israel or not.
Right.
Okay? And yet we have situations where Bedouins are just camping out wherever they want, stealing electricity from wherever they want, and getting away with it.
Yeah.
And so now there's a new law that the Knesset is in the process of passing that will forbid these illegal encampments from hooking themselves up to electricity just because they feel like it. Okay. So they're moving in a direction of legislation and enforcement to enforce Jewish Israeli sovereignty, you know, the rule of law. And one of the Arab party who is a member of the current government is making a fuss over this law. And Ayelet Shaked, who is, you know, very, you know, she's a minister of interior and a very powerful woman, a wonderful woman. She's standing firm against this. Now, what will end up happening with this law? I don't know. But this is a prime example where an Arab party who is very problematic, okay, is trying to stop the rule of law.
Exactly. I mean, with Judea and Samaria, the EU. They're culpable. How on earth can that? That's illegal. It's not as though there's not a law written clearly.
Right. And the EU is clearly interfering in what is domestic politics and domestic law. And they're not allowed to do this. And yet Israel doesn't have the, I don't know what, to stand up to the EU and enforce it. And I don't know why. It is a huge puzzlement. And when I counter these things, my attitude has always been, you know, I can't fix the world. I'm not the prime minister of Israel. I can't even fix Israel. Okay. What I can do is what I can do. And that is one of the things that has always stood behind CFOIC. We do what we can do. Okay. So if that means as communities, we have the ability to protect our borders. We have the ability to strengthen our communities, whether it's with security equipment, like some of these smaller pioneering communities that are so-called illegal, and we are pushing for them to become legal. But one of the things we can do other than make them legal, which is out of our hands, but we can strengthen them and make them look and feel permanent by putting, you know, parks and playgrounds and security equipment and whatever it is that is needed to help these people live a more comfortable life, a safer life there, and makes it that much harder for anyone to come and say, oh, it's just a fly-by-night place, we're taking it down. So these are the kinds of things. And of course, the most important thing is the individuals who actually go out and live in these places. Mm. These young families who give up the comforts of home. You know, there's one story that one of the communities that we really are working very hard to help is called Givat Hanan. And it's a part of Susia. And there's a family who had just moved into their brand new home in Susia, literally just unpacked their boxes. And people came to them and said, we have to settle this new hill across the road. Will you help us? And they got up, left their brand new home, and took them and their four children and moved into a tiny little caravan. I mean, it's mind-boggling the dedication of people like that. These are the real heroes. And so what we need to do is support these heroes, because it's because of these heroes doing what ordinary people can do that ends up pushing the politicians as much as we can.
Right, yeah.
Sandra, I have a question. When the covenant was given, was this considered a religious, you said there was an altar, was this considered a religious service? And if it was, were men and women separated at this service? Does this justify the mechitza or not?
I don't think there were any mechitzas or divisions between men and women in ancient times. Now, maybe they stood separate. I have no idea. We do know in the temple there was an area that was called the women's section. It's certainly not something that we see in the Bible, and it's something that we encounter today. And we don't know what they did in biblical times. I have no idea. And it's anachronistic to take 21st century concepts and to try to put them.
There are those of a certain stream of Judaism who advocate this is where Mechitza started.
But as with Ezra,
I don't think it started in Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, I have to tell you.
In the time of
the text specifically says the women and the children are all together with the men. So maybe they put the women over here and the men over here, but there was like 2 million people there. You know, I think they were just all standing around. So I'm not worried, you know, whatever.
Anyway. I also like that included the foreigners as well.
Of course.
God's always had a place for the Gentiles to be grafted in.
Well, you know what? It's interesting. We're going to deal with this in more detail next week. Next week, we are going to move on to chapter 9, and we have the story of the Gibeonites. And this raises this whole question of what is the relationship of the children of Israel as they come into the land to the people that they are conquering? And we're going to be discussing that issue and what are the minimums that would be required from the people to in order for them to live in peace with Israelites. And these are issues that we will be dealing with next week. So stay tuned.
Excellent.
Okay. Thank you very much,
anyway,
Sandra.
Thank you so much.
All the best for your daughter's delivery.
All the best, yeah. Yes,
thank you. I will keep you posted when she has her baby, please, guys.
Wonderful.
Okay. I hope you enjoyed that video. And we'd like to be sure you're getting all of our video content. So just click on the subscribe button below as well as on the notification bell. And that way you will have easy access to all our material. We look forward to staying in touch with you. God bless you and have a wonderful day.